what we are already seeing is the concept of shadow Gen AI tools, where I think there was a recent survey around the world, like at least 20% of employees admit to using un-IT approved Gen AI tools as part of their workflow.
Yes.
That's a huge opportunity because people are already, like, you're not having to pilot something and do a huge change management thing. You're actually just needing to create the space for employees to say, well, I'm already doing this. Can we do this so it's safe? Like, can I tell you about it without getting in trouble? Because innovation's probably already everywhere, and maybe you're just not harnessing it.
Welcome to the Inner Game of Change podcast, where I explore the intricate layers of organizational change alongside insightful professionals. I am your host, Ali Juma, and this is the Inner Game of Change podcast. Today, I welcome Sarah Kaur, a design thinking practitioner at the Commonwealth Scientific and Industrial Research Organization. With a robust background, Sarah brings over a decade of experience collaborating across disciplines to embed human-centric design in machine learning and AI research. Her work focuses on responsible AI, striving to enhance policy and consumer experiences through ethical and technically sound AI applications. Sarah's dedication shines through her own projects. Today, Sarah and I go through the rabbit hole of AI design for impact, exploring the intersection of creativity, ethics, and technology. I am grateful to have Sarah chatting with me today. Well, Sarah, so good to have you in my podcast, the Inner Game of Change podcast, as a guest. And it's really good to see you. And thank you so much for your time in advance.
Yeah, thank you, Ali. Really good to be here.
Thank you very much. Today, Sarah, we're going to talk about lots about the exciting technology of AI. Perhaps we're going to touch a lot on generative AI as well. Mm-hmm. But before we start, it'll be fantastic to introduce yourself to my audience.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm Sarah Kaur, and I currently work at CSIRO in Data 61 as a design thinking practitioner. So my journey to get here is really, I started out as an artist doing a lot of arts festival productions, engaging with communities and community artists to really bring forward, I suppose, the concerns and express it in an artistic way. And from there, I was starting to be hungry for like a pointier challenge. So how can I use creative skills and production skills, but instead of applying them for arts events, apply them to, I guess, more real world challenges? So I switched and started working as a producer and a designer in digital consulting agencies. And eventually this led me to understand and become a human-centered design practitioner. And so that's probably how I describe myself mostly now. Human-centered design is a methodology that seeks to put the needs, the hopes, the motivations, sometimes, you know, working around the fears of individuals. So really starting to understand people, empathize with them, engage with them deeply on any change or, you know, new innovation that you want to have, and even co-design with them. So letting experts lead the design of a solution, of a change process. And my job is to expertly facilitate that process. So we come up with something really good, something with good impact at the end.
Fantastic. And for my audience who are actually overseas and all the good things come from your agency, talk to me about how did you get into AI and that particular sort of rabbit hole?
Oh, it's such a rabbit hole. It's like an expanding universe of rabbit holes.
yes.
I think it all started for me when I, you know, working in digital agencies for the last 15 years, we really started to see, I guess, more and more, not just reliance and not more innovation in digital tools, but I started to see everything is becoming digital, right? So how you and I go about our world, our daily life is augmented more and more by the creation of data in digital systems. Like we as humans, now we're starting to be represented as ones and zeros in different databases. And I started to become very interested in how humans are represented in digital forms and how AI systems or machine learning models and data sets that are used to train these models, how they represent humans and how they can be designed to be responsibly deployed in service of human needs. So it was a little bit of a leap, and I needed to detour and upskill in a bit of data science and analytics along the way. But that's kind of, yeah, it comes from an ethical standpoint and a belief in design as a methodology that can complement a technical skill set.
Fantastic. I am curious. So I'm trying to marry the two, human-centered design with an AI technology as an augmentation tool. How do you see those two components, you know, mixed together?
In so many ways. So I think design can be used in conjunction or in collaboration with data scientists to, let's say, make decisions about the way an algorithm is trained, but also how it's presented as an interface or process with other humans, right? Mm-hmm. So there's probably a good case study that allows us to touch on the various ways, and maybe that can make it a bit more concrete.
Sure.
Okay. So we're going back in time. I was working with a company called Portable. Portable is a design research development agency that is really guided by, you know, purpose-oriented missions. So one of the focus areas was, let's make an impact in access to justice. So back in 2018, we started to notice one of the perhaps low-hanging fruits that we could start to tackle in family law was separations, so financial separations, parenting consent orders. The family court in Australia was experiencing huge backlogs. And even if you weren't going to court, it would typically cost a couple like $10,000 to separate in lawyers' fees. And, you know, lots of Australian households don't have that spare $10,000. So we thought, look, why don't we use emerging technology? And I think AI, ML back in 2017-18 was still in that emergent phase. And we thought, all right, can we identify the right problem to solve in the right way so that couples are less reliant on family lawyers to get to separation agreements? And so what we started to do was look at typical ways that machine learning algorithms are trained. We identified that one of the things that family lawyers do is suggest a fair financial split of a total asset pool that a couple's built together. And family lawyers will consider different contributions that have been made, different assets, but also future needs, especially where there's a child concerned. So we thought, okay, if that's one of the key things that we currently need to rely on family lawyers to do, that suggest a fair split of assets, can we train a model to be able to do that? So once we've validated that theoretically it's possible, we started to have to research the best practice kind of methods and techniques to do to build a model like that. And typically you would use a historical database of family court decisions to kind of say, look, considering these variables, the algorithm knows that historically the court has said this is a fair split for this type of case. But here's where I think that human-centered design kind of decision-making starts to come in. We needed to understand and empathize not only with the end users, so couples going through separation, but also with family lawyers who ultimately are stakeholders in a change piece like this. And what they started to tell us was, yes, that might be best practice, but have you considered that the amount of training data you need would take you needing to go back in history to like the 70s? And in the 70s, how family like law considered the contribution of, say, a woman's labor and childminding, child rearing, and taking care of the home. Perhaps that doesn't actually line up with contemporary Australian values or the financial contribution that we now recognize. So maybe it's actually inappropriate and plain wrong to use that kind of data, even though that's best technical practice. So this is an example of how I think engaging, doing your research into a topic as a designer really helps you surface those insights and make decisions with your technical data science counterparts to say, look, I'm not a technical expert, but I can tell you that this best practice isn't going to work. What other options do we have? And so that started a whole series of design decisions around creating a synthetic data set around how to engage family lawyers to train a model from scratch for us. And I guess it started to really influence the way I saw the development of AI. So not just the models, but also how that model is explained to someone who has to use it and how we build trust in that system's ability to influence our decision making. And so that was, yeah, that was probably the start of me going, algorithms and AI isn't just a technical area. It's a design decision area that is influenced by what we value and the impact that we ultimately want to have.
That's a fantastic use case. I've heard a lot about what AI is doing in the law sector, even passing exams, which is really great. Holistically, from where you sit, what do we need to look at when we want to build the trust, the algorithms, the way you design it? So then we have trust in the outcome. We started thinking about it, and I think this will be a revolutionary step. And maybe this is the way to create that unbiased equity if we do it right.
There's so much in what you just said, but
yes,
maybe
I know. This is I'm talking like an ignorant person, so all of these things are coming into my mind. But so we hear a lot about responsible AI, auditable AI, ethical AI. I suppose they may mean slightly differently, but the intention is the same. How do I trust the output of this of this technology?
Yeah, absolutely. And maybe just to expand on why it's so critical to have trust. I think there's been multiple surveys done in Australia by firms like McKinsey, but also really targeted research by University of Queensland that looks at the attitudes of the general public and their trust in companies' use of AI. And what we're seeing is that Australia, generally is considered a bit of a laggard when it comes to technology adoption. And specifically when it comes to AI, we're starting to see that we could have so much amazing productivity growth. We could really start to, drive forward innovation and the market share that we have. But what's holding us back is that about only 40%, I think, of people surveyed say, yep, we trust companies to use AI for our benefit or for good, or in a way that we can actually understand it. So there's a huge skepticism. And I think if you think about the very complex landscape of what does responsible or ethical or safe use of AI, we start to see that companies, CEOs, board directors, they're so accountable for the use of these technologies, but they may not be clear yet about the interaction of how AI either enhances opportunities or enhances their risk profile. In a lot of frameworks around safe and responsible AI, we start to see people saying, look, first of all, consumer law, privacy law, any business is already going to be subject to lots of legal and regulatory compliance obligations. So your first step is to make sure that however you're using AI, it's not in conflict, I suppose, or you're not exposing to risks that you're not comfortable taking according to your existing obligations. And then I think there's a second level where we think and talk about not just do no harm. So don't allow data to be accessed when it shouldn't, but it's actually around values alignment. In 2019, the Department of Industry and Data 61 did a very wide-scale public consultation, came up with 8 Australian AI ethics principles, and they're generally aligned with, I guess, international AI principles and human rights being expressed. But I think they're just one input, right? Every organization will need to look at those principles and then figure out, how does that interact with my company mission, my purpose, my values, how I implement those with my use of AI, with my employees. That's actually a really, I think, like quite a fertile ground for education around AI ethics and company values and how you want to express them. So that's, I think, the second order. Mm. And the third order, which I know is very close to your heart, is so what? Like, so what if you're complying with the law? So what if all your values are aligned? What is the impact it's having on your external world? Mm. So are your consumers benefiting? In the case of Amica, what the business case was basically, let's take a $10,000 case and reduce the cost to make it more accessible. And couples can now generate that from $150 to $500. So that's a very clear case of external impact and access for a purpose. So if any company can kind of go through the steps from obligation and doing no harm to values alignment to then saying we really care and want to track, we want to get signals back from outside on how our use of AI is creating impact, I think those kind of three pillars are going to be really increasingly important to demonstrate that you are trustworthy.
I want to shift gear and I want to talk about along the same line, but take it a little bit further, which is around, if it was a normal change, we probably have got a lot of examples of that in the past, and therefore we can perhaps safely predict the impacts.
Yeah,
because AI is evolving very quickly. Even the experts are grappling now. Do we understand, you know, where this is going to take us? When they ask such a question, that what the message that I'm reading out of the question is that we really don't understand the second and third layer of impact. How nervous would that make you feel?
I think it gives me a reason to pause and like kind of try and appreciate the complexity. But I also recognize that we can't afford to always stop or get bogged down because the complexity is beyond our current understanding. Mm. So I think it's helpful for me to ask leaders in organizations that are considering AI strategy, deployment, and impact. It's helpful for me to say something like, look, if I asked you to tell me, how confident are you that this service or this product that you're releasing is accessible and is aligned to the cultural diversity of the user base that you serve? So they might say, good question, I haven't thought about it. Or they might be a little bit more mature and they've said, you know, well, we've checked it against our diversity and inclusion guidelines. We don't think there's anything wrong. We're working with our AI vendor. We're making sure that the bias is being really, you know, well monitored in the system. And then I'll say, okay, but so what? Have you talked to people out there? Have you tried to reach out to your customers? Have you done things like seeking out the guidance and the feedback of a leader in a vulnerable community to say, look, this is what my product's doing. I don't know from my perspective what the potential impacts might be for you, but maybe we can speculate together and you don't need to know a lot of technical detail about what I'm doing. But if I say my product might do this, and let you ask a question about how that might actually filter down into people in your community, maybe we can have a discussion that starts to flesh out those areas that were previously unknown that actually we might say, gosh, that's a connection I never knew. Let's think about monitoring this for unintended consequences. Mm. So it's about like little ripples of engagement. You go out, you go out, you go out, and eventually you start getting signals back. You can't start there, and it takes a lot of investment and resource, but it's kind of what we need to do, I think.
The way I look at it is that, yes, It is fraught with a lot of uncertainty, but we've got thousands and thousands of human experience that we can explore that and really understand it. And perhaps also we can be naughty enough to rely on technology to even predict the impacts of itself on society. So who knows? We might get in there. I was in the supermarket the other day, Sarah, and I was thinking a couple of things. I was thinking a product can have a genetically modified label on it, or organic label on it. Are we going to get to a stage when there's a product from a company or a policy or a program is going to have a tag on it, AI tag?
Don't know the answer to that, but I definitely see certain signals coming through. So, for example, the US Bill of Materials for AI is starting to say we want a watermark for AI-generated images. And maybe that's, you know, for there's lots of political sensitivities around fake news and the
yes.
of generative AI for bad political kind of actors. But I think in general, it's important for companies to be transparent with anyone who is using an AI-assisted kind of service or product. And that's for a few reasons. One of the core, I guess, AI ethics principles is be transparent about what you're doing, why you're doing it. And the fundamental, you know, like step one is, well, let people know that they're actually interacting with AI. But that kind of is foundational for a few reasons when we think about impact. If we are truly serious about wanting to assess the impact of what we're doing, whether that's good or bad, we won't know unless people are firstly aware that it's that's kind of an attribute of the tech that they're using. And then they can start to tell you like, it's actually really amazing. Or I just wasn't sure why this hotel was recommended to me. Or there might be other use cases where, for example, in finance, we're starting to see a lot of credit pre-application screening happening. For example, that's a quite a high-risk use case of AI. And so we need to be able to allow for people to give us signals back to say, this thing, I wasn't sure why it actually told me that. Can I ask a question about it? And actually, that's how companies get better and do continual improvement, is because they start to detect edge cases and start to be able to improve their modeling or improve their data sources.
I love that. Using transparency to improve your own processes. That's really great. So here are some thoughts that I've been also thinking about. Lots of people are thinking that AI is a threat to their own jobs. And I think their concern is valid. I know, for example, myself, there are elements in my own practice that probably AI can do it, obviously, way faster. And probably at some stage in the future, it will learn from me a lot that will be doing it faster and far more accurately. I do believe that the human myself in the link and in the cycle is irreplaceable. It means for me that AI can help me manage the tasks that don't need a lot of insight from me, but they do take time now. And then I can focus on helping my clients with insight and value. So that's how I see it. But one of the things the other day I was thinking about is that if transparency will be a big topic, who knows? Currently, we have auditors on financial performance of companies. Maybe the future will be, or not the future, maybe next couple of years will be an auditor for AI transparency. Meaning auditors will come to your company and then they check that your AI is ethical or meeting the standards that you asked. Am I dreaming about this?
I think it's a shared ambition and a shared desire that we have. I don't know if we're dreaming about, you know, when, how, the practicality, the feasibility of how that might be implemented here, but I feel like it's almost like a shared goal that is starting to emerge, or a shared need that is starting to emerge.
Yeah.
But I do want to go back to the point you were making around, you know, AI threat, friend, foe, what is it? One of the people I spoke to recently who is, you know, has helped lots of organizations think about adopting AI all the way through from piloting something to actually having a mature use case in the business. He was saying, look, if you think about your AI tool as an intern, like particularly relevant for Gen AI, you know, you can't leave your intern alone to crack through a bunch of tasks and then take their output and give that to your boss. Like, you would definitely not do that. Mm. You would definitely be very specific in your instructions to an intern. And so should you be with a tool like Midjourney or ChatGPT. You would never leave an intern alone to run a task over several days without checking in. So put yourself back in the loop. So that kind of principle of human comes back in the loop with your AI kind of process comes in, and also treat their output as an input to your process. So never use it verbatim, never use it raw. Always augment it with the wisdom that you've got, the experience that you've got, because anything that comes out of, let's say, an LLM chatbot is going to hold a lot of generic and applicable insights or output, but that's where your human discretion, wisdom, insight, experience needs to really deliver that value. And that's not something that's cheap or easy to come by. That's human. You've earned it. And that's very valuable.
Yeah, that's what I call a professional wisdom. I also think I like that the output of AI is an input into your own work. I think that's really nice put. I often describe it that the information is right, but it's not the truth.
That's a great saying. Yeah.
So the truth, I only know the truth. Well, I know part of the truth anyway, but that comes from years of experience. And sometimes as humans, we really just need a start. And AI can give us that particular start. If AI is going to augment my work, what do you think people in the workplace would need to start thinking about? So one of the things that I heard recently is that we need to start thinking that I am working with AI and not with computers anymore. Is that the new way of working that will evolve at some stage?
It's really, I've been thinking about that, like, your metaphors for AI, like our use of laptops is really ubiquitous. It wasn't always. It hasn't actually taken away more jobs than it's created, let's say. Mm-hmm. Or even thinking about a metaphor like AI as electricity. It used to be dangerous and crazy, but over time, it's evolved to have so many applications, universal standards, safety. Like it's become a commodity that we all use and trust.
Yeah.
And no doubt that AI is going to happen or have a similar trajectory. But I think there's, have you heard of Carol Sanford? She's a US based kind of, she talks a lot about regenerative businesses and kind of creating a culture where everyone in an organization understands the vision, but they also understand when they are stepping outside of what they should be doing. And because they know the vision where they should be going, and they know very clearly, if I step outside this line, I will get in some serious consequential trouble. They also understand the zone of relative autonomous freedom where they can do their jobs to the best of their ability. And I think it's really important for organizations to start being quite clear about their expectations of the use of AI. So having a fair use of AI policy that's internal and very clear starts to give employees the signals they need to say, look, I might, in my job, because I'm a frontline worker, I know that my job could be greatly enhanced by, I don't know, like having an email template for this or that Gen AI could use. I know that I would be stepping well outside the bounds of expected norms if I put in my customer data into ChatGPT, but I need to know from the organization, do you have plans to have an internal kind of facing tool for me to do this? Because otherwise, what we are already seeing is the concept of shadow Gen AI tools, where I think there was a recent survey around the world, like at least 20% of employees admit to using un-IT approved Gen AI tools as part of their workflow.
Yes.
That's a huge opportunity because people are already, like, you're not having to pilot something and do a huge change management thing. You're actually just needing to create the space for employees to say, well, I'm already doing this. Can we do this so it's safe? Like, can I tell you about it without getting in trouble? Because innovation's probably already everywhere and maybe you're just not harnessing it. And so I really, believe that it's a huge shift that employers can do a lot to harness.
I'm going to look up that person. What was their name again?
Carol Sanford.
Excellent. I'll look up that name again because I'm really interested in it now. A couple of things. You did mention about the survey around Australians don't have a lot of trust in there. I think that's because of our nature. We are cynical most of the time, and it is going to take a lot of time. This will pose a challenge when it comes to change adoption in the workplace, which means that we need to allow a little bit of longer runway for Australia to adopt. But once we adopt it, we are cool with it. The other thing that you mentioned is, which is really an interesting topic that I've spent a lot of time over the last 3 weeks in particular, which is exactly what you just mentioned. I actually analyzed the way open source AI, the mother company, and Microsoft, and even Google, how they manage their change adoption for their technology. So they give it to you, you play with it, and then they augment it with other bits and pieces. You are right. So one of the things that I started thinking about working with my clients is that unlike the normal change, which is we're going to communicate that to you, we're going to train you on it, then we give you access. This particular one, as you mentioned, I'm aware of that survey. In fact, about 65% of people lie when they say we don't use it, they still use it, which is there's a stigma around the cheating part of it, but that will go away very quickly because if you think about it, Excel works out formulas for us. That's not cheating. I just even, you know, I'm not going to work it out myself. So what I'm doing now is that we give access. We allow them a good period of time to play with that, and then we come and bridge the gap with the training, and then we sustain it and reinforce it later. It's a different approach with this particular one. It might look easier, but when you deal, I think American society is far more open to new technologies than Australia. That doesn't mean they're better or you know, worse, but it just means that that's how society operates and that's how change would need to be looked at when it comes to the workplace. I'm curious to know, especially in generative AI, personally, how do you use it and for what purposes?
I use it for so many different things. An example of how I use it to extend my practice as a design thinking practitioner is I find it really good at helping me speculate alternate scenarios. Speculative design typically is the practice where you say, what if we had a new technology and it's delivered like a chatbot, like ChatGPT, and everyone in the world can use it? What happens in 5 years? What happens in 10 years? And you actually start to construct plausible narratives that let you explore future models of what that impact over, you know, two or three horizons might be.
Yeah.
I used to do this primarily with humans in workshops, and we'd bring in little tools, and sometimes we'd deliberately kind of, you know, frame it with this is the dystopia sci-fi version, this is the utopia version, how do we get there? But what I'm finding is if I try and do the same thing with, say, a ChatGPT, I can get a lot more diversity in the types of scenarios that it gives me. And I'm able to use those as the inputs for the workshop. And what I'm typically finding is with that higher quality, more targeted, more inventive, speculative scenarios being presented to humans as kind of framing an input, suddenly the humans are like, oh my gosh, yes, let me build on that. Like, I think in my context or from my culture, this would play out like this. And we start to get a lot of nuance and a lot of believable quality in the generation of scenarios that talk about impact. And of course, what you do then as a designer is you think, great, how do I steer us closer to the kind of impact we want to have and further away from the terrible impacts it could have because we've allowed ourselves a chance to speculate about the future.
Fantastic. I predominantly Copilot and ChatGPT 4. I did an experiment about a month ago. I had a bottle of wine and then I spent about 90 minutes with ChatGPT and Copilot. I've given it a lot of information. I've given it a lot of context. And in fact, I thought about the context to work out how I can improve my practice in the changing comms in about 3 years' time. What do I need to consider? And I basically workshopped my own job future with ChatGPT. And it was amazing because it's giving me some of the stuff that I know about, but it's giving me some other pointers that I haven't really thought about and considered. And then based on that, I've selected the pathway that I want to go through. And then I asked ChatGPT to put all of those into a plan based on the number of years and what I need to do, including even if there are courses that I need to finish, and recommended the courses to me. Quite amazing, powerful thing, because that's what you go and pay thousands of dollars to a coach, and they may not get it right as well. And that information stays with me. So the other thing that I started using Copilot, especially over the last 6 months, to help me even with the podcast, I give it a set of questions and I ask it to critique my questions. I've got a limited amount of time with my guest and I want to get the best questions out there to get the best outcome from the guest. So how can he help me sharpen my questioning techniques? And it's actually been powerful for me even outside the podcasting. So as I said, I am almost falling in love with ChatGPT, and at some stage I'm going to create my own and give it a name as well. It's going to be a great thing. I do believe in the technology. I do believe that when I was living overseas in the 90s and I started hearing about internet and from the geeks of my friends, I ignored it. I didn't take really big advantage of it at the time. And I think this is the second inflection point in humanity. And that's why I'm taking it so seriously and going so deeper into that rabbit hole, because that's, for me anyway, once in a lifetime opportunity to really just harness this technology. For me, we are coming close to the end of the podcast. I'm thoroughly enjoying this. You've given me quite a few points to think about. I've learned, and I'm going to steal some of the language that you used in there, Sarah. So I hope you don't mind that. One last question that I want to ask you, which I usually ask my guests: what would be your advice to people in my community in the changing communication, knowing what you know, what we do, Sarah?
I think I'd say a piece of advice or maybe an insight that I heard you touch on in your story about your own interactions with ChatGPT. I think that what we have access to now is an incredibly powerful technology that is able to aggregate basically the internet and synthesize it for us. And that's such an amazing, potentially democratizing, powerful force where every one of us, there is still a digital divide. It's not completely accessible, but a great number of us are now able to get generic advice tailored to our situation that is roughly equivalent to what, like you said, we would have had to pay a specialist a good deal of money for. But that's not the end of the insight. I think The interaction style. So me, a human, talking to a machine on my computer, I actually have a lot less inhibitions about the way I will ask for feedback. Like you were saying, can you help me critique my questions? I might not be brave enough to do that with a human expert. I might not want to seem vulnerable, or I might not want to waste their time. But what we have in technologies like this now is almost the endless ability to have a back and forth where we don't feel like we're under a spotlight or judged, like we have a thinking partner. Or if you're creating an image, you can kind of go, like, it doesn't get tired. It doesn't get sick of you saying, oh, stop telling me to make it, you know, more green or whatever.
Yes.
It's actually a very patient and powerful technology. So if we understand its limitations, if we understand that whatever it gives us is an input to the thing that we want to make, I think that's a huge framing about empowering people to use technology and be able to do that productively and within a safe kind of environment where they are confident too.
Thank you very much. Very wise, and I think is going to change experiences all over the place. Recently, I've had a guest that talked about, we talked about the idea of cheating for students and all of that, which is prevalent, you know, topic. And because that we are humans, we're going to look at the negative news first, which is fine. But she was talking about that, who knows, an A now, an excellent A in an assignment is based on what we know now. When we have AI to help with research and all of that, that A will no longer have the same standard as now. We're going to have to raise the standard of learning because we've got a capability now. And this is how we're going to transform the human intelligence and the output. And I reckon that will be a huge win to humanity. Of course, there's going to be some evil use of it. Of course, it's already happening, but that never stops us. And I hope that one day technology can help us cure cancer, you know, climate change, all of those things that I'm not a dreamer. I know is going to happen. It's just a matter of how much human will come into place to make that happen. So on that note, I really appreciated your time today, Sarah. I was grateful to hear your thoughts and listen to you, and I'm eternally grateful for your time.
It's been a pleasure chatting. I've learnt as well. Thank you, Ali, for bringing the conversation to life. And I've really appreciated your use of like specific stories as well. I love that. Also as a listener of your podcast. So
thank you very much. How would people get hold of you, Sarah, if they want to connect with you?
They can connect with me via LinkedIn, Sarah Tamara Kaur. But I would also encourage people to maybe sign up to the National the National Artificial Intelligence Center newsletter if you're in Australia, because we're starting to put out a lot of expectations around change for safe and responsible AI from a government and industry perspective. We also have lots of industry thought leaders starting to discuss how they're using AI and applying it in their industry. It's a pretty good source of trustworthy knowledge. So that's another place to look out for some good resources.
Fantastic. I'm going to put all the information in the podcast info. I hope to get you back in the future at some stage, and things would have moved very quickly, I'm sure, by then. But until next time, Sarah, stay well and stay safe.
Thank you, Ali. Bye.
Thank you. Thank you for listening. If you found this episode valuable, remember to subscribe to stay updated on upcoming episodes. Your support is truly appreciated. And by sharing this podcast with your colleagues, friends, and fellow change practitioners, it can help me reach even more individuals and professionals who can benefit from these discussions. Remember, and in my opinion, change is an enduring force, and you will only have a measure of certainty and control when you embrace it. Until next time, thank you for being part of the Inner Game of Change community. I am Ali Jama, And this is the Inner Game of Change podcast.
It's great. It was so natural. Thank you. You're a great host. Just felt like a conversation, you know?